Hello and welcome to a new edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior. This is the foreign service of the Argentine Radio, transmitting from the city of Buenos Aires via the shortwaves of WRMI, Miami Radio International, and also via internet on rae.com.ar. This is Fernando Farias speaking, and together with sound technician Walter Danesi, we'll be bringing you this show in English for Tuesday, November 19, 2024. We'll have news, sports, music. Speaking of music, we'll be honoring Mauricio Viravent, his actual name, but his stage name is Maurice, an important figure in the history of Argentine rock, who's turning 82 today. And 82 to the turn also Daniel Barenboim last week. We're going to play more content related to him, the part two of the conversation that he had back in 1999 with Palestinian American thinker Edward Said, which is the partnership that gave life to the West East Divan Orchestra that brings together young Palestinian and Israeli musicians in an effort to promote peace in the Middle East. We'll also be sharing with you the DX supplement of every week that is produced by Arnaldo Slain. If you want to get in touch with us, send an email to qslrai@gmail.com or a letter to Maipú Street 555 and then, of course, Buenos Aires, Argentina. Either way is okay for sending reception reports. Let me remind you that you can also listen to us via our app for mobile devices that you can download for free. The frequency for this show on WRMI is 5850 kHz. Let's get started now with the news. These are the headlines. Argentina signs G20 declaration with dissent over the 2030 agenda. Uruguay presidential candidates debate ahead of next Sunday's runoff. Ecuador declares a 60-day state of emergency over wildfires and power cuts. Argentina and Brazil sign a Vaca Muerta gas export deal. Paraguayan president hospitalized at G20 summit. Sports. Argentina faces Peru in World Cup qualifier. And these are the news. Argentina has signed the G20 declaration in Rio de Janeiro, but expressed dissent over the Agenda 2030. At Casa Rosada, they released a communique asserting that President Javier Milei is opposing measures such as a tax on the wealth and climate action. In his speech, he also criticized global organizations such as the UN for not serving its original purpose of defending the basic rights of citizens. Mr. Milei also argued that reducing state intervention is the solution to hunger and poverty. Despite these reservations, Argentina joined Brazil's proposal to establish a global alliance against hunger and poverty. Uruguay is heading into its presidential runoff this weekend. The race pits conservative Álvaro Delgado against leftist Yamandú Orsi, who polls suggest is the frontrunner. In last night's televised debate, Orsi pledged a secure change that would unify Uruguay and allow citizens to improve their life standards and make ends meet. Delgado countered by emphasizing a choice between certainty under his national party and what he described as a risky return to the past under Orsi's broad front coalition. Ecuador has declared a 60-day national emergency due to ongoing wildfires. Officials report 17 active fires, with 5 under control, mainly in the southern provinces of Azuay and Loja. This comes on top of other problems, like a drought that has severely affected hydroelectric power generation. scheduled blackouts, especially in Quito, can last up to 14 hours. President Daniel Noboa's administration has been implementing them since September to save energy. Argentina has signed an agreement to export natural gas from its Vaca Muerta shale fields to Brazil. The deal, formalized on the sidelines of the G20 summit, involves exploring new routes to deliver up to 2 million cubic meters of gas per day. The accord was inked by Argentina's economy minister Luis Caputo and the Brazilian energy and mines minister Alexandre Silveira. The latter told reporters the move aims to boost gas supply and lower prices in Brazil. Paraguay's president Santiago Peña was hospitalized while attending the G20 summit in Rio de Janeiro. Officials reported he suffered an indisposition. A statement from the Samaritano Hospital of Rio confirmed the 46-year-old leader is in stable condition and recovering well. And now, sports. Argentina's national football team will face Peru tonight in its final match of the year, part of the qualifiers for the 2026 World Cup. The Albiceleste aims to recover from a 2-1 loss to Paraguay last Thursday. Coach Lionel Scaloni urged the team to play seriously, expressing confidence in their unity and ability to create opportunities despite recent setbacks. And these were the news on RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo. RAE, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けて, Argentina.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo.
RAE, Argentina in the world.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo.
And last Friday was the 82 anniversary birthday, actually, of Daniel Barenboim, the legendary, acclaimed conductor born in Argentina who holds both Israeli, Argentine and Palestinian nationality as well. A very talented pianist. And a very successful orchestra conductor who is also known for his work for advancing and promoting peace in the Middle East, most notably the Divan, the West East Divan Orchestra, integrated by young musicians from Palestine and Israel that play together in an effort to champion and promote peace in the Middle East. Part of that initiative is intellectual Edward Said, Palestinian-American thinker and a good friend of Barenboim. Together, they are the creators of the orchestra. There is a very nice talk that they had that was uploaded to YouTube, and we're going to be sharing part two of that very thought-provoking conversation between these two great men, Daniel Barenboim and Edward Said. And we are playing this on the occasion of the birthday of Maestro Barenboim, who's undergoing some health problems and has been off the public spotlight for some time. We hope he recovers and is back on stage and performing music again in the way he does, which inspires millions around the world. And we'll have that after listening to some music by Barenboim, in this case, his performance of the movement number 3 of the Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven.
Thank you. But you know, I'm very interested in the sound itself, which is what musicians produce, and it isn't. I mean, it isn't a neutral thing, is it? You don't think of it as just producing a sound, do you? I mean, there's a lot to it. Besides the merely technical, or would you say it's just a technical thing?
No, it is. Of course, it is not a technical thing, and in fact, the only definition about music that can be accepted, if you want, as philosophically correct, is a definition through sound, because everything else speaks about the reaction of the beholder, the observer.
Right.
And I think Busoni was, you know, who said it's sonorous air. That's really, it sounds terribly simple, but it's really, in the end, all it is. And I think that sound, when people speak about sound, they speak about sound as of a sound spectacular, or a beautiful sound, or a dark sound, or a bright sound, or an ugly sound, or a beautiful sound. But these are all very empirical definitions. They have nothing to do really with the matter itself. And I think if you observe sound, certain things are immediately obvious. First of all, it doesn't inhabit the world. In other words, you have to bring him. You have to bring it to the room. It's not that the sound is there. Everything, all the technical means that we have developed, technological developments to preserve sound, are artificial. It's like a deep freeze. I mean, whether it is cassette or records, and the sound itself doesn't exist. The Beethoven 7 that we played yesterday doesn't exist anymore today. It will exist somewhere in the corner of the earth when... So when you observe, then you have to observe the relationship between sound and silence. Very often it is talked about the beauty of the relation between two sounds. The first is the relation between the first sound
and
that comes
silence
after the silence that precedes it. And from then on. And I think if you observe it, then you see that sound has a relationship with silence, not unlike the law of gravity. In other words, to lift an object from the ground, you have to use so much energy to sustain it in the air. You have to add energy, otherwise it falls down. And it's the same thing with the sound. You need so much energy to produce the sound. And you have to keep on giving the energy after that in order to maintain it. Now, this is relatively easy to understand when you're talking about a wind player who has so much air, or even a string instrument who, by drawing the bow can sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what shows you that the art of playing the piano is the art of creating illusion, because in the piano, so to speak, you cannot do that. And it is exactly this tension in the relationship between sound and silence that begins to give the music its expressive quality. In other words, if you produce one sound and sustain it for a certain amount of time and then let it die, you have experienced exactly that, a small death.
Mm.
And I think this is, for me, why there is a tragic quality inherent in the idea, in the concept of music, regardless of whether it is a comic opera or a funny finale of a Haydn symphony. At its most lighthearted, there is an element of tragedy in music that comes from that.
And I mean, somebody like Wagner, who was so obsessed with the creation of a particular sound, is that part of, I mean, I've often tried to figure out. I mean, you know, I mean, was Beethoven that interested in the quality of the sound and the whole context of the sound?
I don't think so. I think that this is a phenomenon that started
that
happening in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's a developmental thing.
I think so.
I mean, because, you know, you have the instance of Bach, for example, where it's clearly not specified what instruments are playing. I mean, you know, the Art of Fugue could be played on an organ, could be played on a cembalo, could be played by an orchestra. It's sort of unimportant to him, really, what the sound is.
I think that Wagner was, I mean, he was a very systematic person also, and he was tried to bring everything to a level of consciousness. And Wagner was interested not only in the color of sound, but in the expressivity of the continuity of sound. In other words, that the sound that keeps going in itself creates tension. And of course, added to that, all the harmonic complexities, the famous Tristan chord and the resolution of the dissonance, or rather the half resolution, half so that every longer answer brings in itself another question. It's very Talmudic, actually. Yeah. Right. I mean, he would turn in his grave if he heard me say it, but I believe that very much, you know, and it very often comes to mind when I conduct Tristan, which I've conducted so many times because it is a piece that is extremely important to me. But I'm very concerned already after the first two bars of the Tristan prelude, and you get already the first half resolution, which in itself poses another question. This is really very Talmudic in many ways. But in any case, Wagner's preoccupation with the...
I recall a line of Adorno's about the Tristan prelude, where he says, in a certain way, Wagner also doesn't really face the consequences of that half resolution. He immediately goes into a kind of episodic repetition, just a half a step higher or whatever it is. In other words, he finds something rather unusual, and instead of developing it, say, the way Beethoven did, he just repeats it as an episode rather than giving it the kind of force. Do you see that?
I mean, he makes it appear again. I prefer that expression to the repetition, but he makes it appear again one step higher. Right. It's true. But in order for the third time to move on.
I see. So you see it all as building
as accumulation,
to the third time. If you're
accumulation.
Right.
Accumulation. I think that the principle of accumulation in Wagner is as important as the principle of fragmentation in Beethoven. In other words, Beethoven makes a statement and then takes part of it and develops it as a fragment.
Right.
This is what
right.
I mean by the fragmentation of Beethoven. And in Wagner, it is an accumulation for me. Mm. And this sort of ability to sustain the sound, this is part of his sort of musical anti-Semitism, in a way, about this, what he called the Jewish way of making music, you know, with sort of ups and downs and the phrasing and not sustaining the sound. I mean, if you want, it was an intellectual justification for his other ideas. I must say, he did not limit that only to the Jews. I mean, he criticized, of course, Italians. The Italians and the French. Mm-hmm. But this is what his...
But do you think, I mean, this is what one thing about Wagner that is interesting to me as you describe him. Do you think this obsessional quality that he has, and the obsessional attention he pays to the production of this continuous sound, has a kind of ideological dimension as well? In other words, you know, I mean, that there is, you can, for me, it's very difficult to separate Wagner, the great composer, from Wagner, the kind of phenomenon, the cultural phenomenon. And I just wonder whether, you know, even if you looked at it as pure music or the creation of a sound, say, in Tristan, whether you're not already entering another territory.
Which is
ideological. I mean, that this is something, it's a particular sound, it's a particular type of mood that he wants, etc., etc. In the end, it's part of a German project. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Maybe going in the direction of a kind of nationalism, where he's very anxious to separate himself from the Italian guitar.
Oh, yes.
And all of that. You see what I'm trying
to
say?
But I mean, this cultural nationalism in Germany is a phenomenon that
grew. Yes.
And well before the Nazis, you know.
You do see it as a development really throughout the 19th century. It doesn't suddenly appear with Wagner.
No, I think it was gradual. I think it was gradual. I think it was gradual. But I have no problem with the characterization of a national element in an artistic matter, be it sound or something else. In other words, I have absolutely no problem with the definition of something as a German sound or a French sound or an Italian sound. And in the case of Germany, of course, it has much more important connotation because it led to the nationalism and the National Socialism and Hitler, etc. But where, for me, this sort of artistic nationalism becomes fascistic is the moment it is expected that only a person of that nation can actually understand that. In other words, for me, it is
understand
obvious
it
that this
also
is
produce it.
Produce it, yeah, especially right. Typically German. It is so Germanic. It is absolutely 100% German, but no outsider. And if you read, in fact, if you read the articles of Furtwängler. I think there were articles or the letters, they were published in any case, about Toscanini's visit to Berlin, which on a superficial level was always meant, were excused as jealousy. I don't think so at all. I mean, he speaks about that. How can this Italian understand this concept, the concept of Germanness?
But how do you, I mean... I find that repulsive, of course, because it's the idea that only certain people have access to a certain kind of thing. Yes, but wait a minute. But then, how much is tolerable of that? You say you have no problem with the notion of German music. I mean, in other words, I agree with that, you see, but I'm just trying to rationalize that to say, well, that's acceptable, to say, well, that's a German sound versus, let's say, a French sound or an English sound. But at what point does that become objectionable? Only when somebody says...
Only a German
can do that.
And I think in the end it's not so important. In the end it's not so... I mean, when I say German sound, it is for me simply a description of what it is.
It's this, not that.
The association. Yeah. But there is a whole sort of philosophical concept of sound production and of music making that can be described as... German, if you want, only for the purpose of association. And that is, Wagner talks a lot about it in his book on conducting, the art of transition. In other words, if you want philosophical terminology, that music is not about being, but about becoming. Mm. And this is why, this leads to all decisions about interpretation. This is why Furtwängler starts something like the Allegro in the third Leonore overture under tempo, in a pianissimo under tempo. Things that today are being criticized as being old-fashioned and limited in time. This is not at all the case. It is simply that he also used the element of flexibility of tempo for the purpose of making it clear that here is a fragment of notes, a group of notes, a musical small unit that is not here, but it is in the process of becoming. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he starts it under tempo, and only when it becomes more and more affirmative does the tempo go along with that, and then it is suddenly there. In other words, if you want the so-called German concept of music and of music writing and of interpretation of music is very much tied to the concept of transition. Mm-hmm. And that something is not what it is in itself, but only in relation to what precedes it and what comes after that. And it is a philosophical thing,
but you could also see... You know that, I mean, the uses to which some of even Beethoven, whom we all think of as a kind of model, heroic somehow, very different from Wagner, figure, right? But you could see the uses that could be made of some of the military aspect of his music. I mean, the kind of triumphalism that you find in say, Fidelio. Whether that too could become a kind of, could be converted to ideological use.
Well, I think use is perhaps not the correct word. It's more abuse.
Yeah, abuse.
It's misuse and abuse. When you think that every Nazi victory was announced in the on the radio in Germany to the sound of Le Prelude of Liszt.
Of Liszt, right.
But you think, what has that music had to do with it? Absolutely nothing. If you read the poem of Lamartine, has nothing to do with that. It has to do with victory. It has to do with life being a prelude or to something else. This is called Le Prelude. If you play the last moment of the Beethoven Fifth as a symbol of victory. I mean, the Nazis managed to convince the world that the Ninth Symphony, that all people will be brothers, that this is what they were about. It was played at all the great Nazi occasions.
No, but you wouldn't subscribe to the notion. I mean, it's a sort of tragic paradox in a way about it, that there's something in also. I mean, I see what you're saying about abuse, but couldn't you also say that there's something in the music, the sound of the cymbals. I mean, cymbals, the snare drum. The triangle, you know, the kind of militaristic quality of some of Beethoven's music, that also predisposes one to pick that for those kind of ideological abuses. It's also an aspect of the music, no?
Of course, like dance is.
Yeah, right.
And that way there's music for wedding, and there's music for ceremonies, and there's music for
so the kind of, it's
funeral.
Yeah. And the way, for example, military marches are played in war, I mean, and parades. I mean, I remember this, one of the earliest and strongest memories I have is during the British period, both in Palestine and Egypt. I mean, the British were there during the Mandate before 48, and in Egypt before they left, in the period of independence after World War II, is the marching bands. I mean, I think they were meant to fill you with a kind of awe for the power of this. You know, and that's why, you know, military dictatorships use bands and parades, and music is always a very important element of that. And it gives a kind of...
pays high dividend in emotional excitement.
Exactly. It really exactly. And it's very cheap to do when you consider. Yeah. I mean, not much is required.
And, you know, I remember that when I was a child, the first time I went to Vienna was in 1952. Vienna was occupied by the four powers, and...
It's Graham Greene time, you know, the Third Man. That's the same period.
The Third Time, yes. Yeah. That's right. Mm. And Oistrakh came and played and suddenly made 1,100 people that sat in the Musikverein side absolutely feel friendly towards the Soviets.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, and this is true. I mean, this is, if you want, the use.
Yeah.
The use of music for bringing people together, in other words. Right. And in a way... In a way, what we did in this in the workshop
also.
Is also that.
Right.
I hope it's not misused.
No, it's not misused because, I mean, in a way it's different though because, I mean, what happened in the workshop, which I found particularly interesting as watching it, I've never watched it before. I mean, obviously, when I played the piano, I used to practice. But watching a rehearsal of several, I mean, of more than one person, which is what you were doing with the orchestra, I'm thinking now, is a gradual sort of accumulation of experience, which builds and builds and builds to a level of a certain kind of clarity. In other words, there's a wonderful expression by an American critic. He says that the critic of literature, it brings literature to performance. And in a certain sense, what a conductor does also is the same thing. He brings music to performance. In other words, not just inert. But that's very different because there is this process through which you live. And it's difficult to see how you could abuse that, though. You see what I mean? What could you say about it?
No, but you see, I don't think that music in itself is moral or immoral.
No, I agree.
It has nothing to do with that.
It
is immoral.
Any more than culture is redemptive. People think it's all about humanity and all the rest.
You know, if you want, take the last moment of the Beethoven 7 that we played yesterday. If you want to use the music to create the association for something that dances and joy, And you play that, and it has that. It has all the energy of the dance. It has the movement of the dance. It has the volume that accumulates. If you want to use it and create the association of something evil, powerful, menacing, distasteful,
you can do it.
The same music is that. And I think that, that's why I say music is amoral, in the sense that it is not immoral. That, in other words, no, the morality.
But amoral presents problems. But I mean, that's what bothered Plato.
Of course, it presents problems.
You could
but
say
I'm saying it is amoral rather than immoral, in the sense that music has no relation with morality, like this,
right,
and
right.
that it is all in one.
Yes, right, right.
All in one.
Yes.
And this is where you get into problems sometimes with characters in operas, right. when music is involved, you know.
Yes.
And then you can twist it, and you can use the music, unless you have a good rapport between conductor and
right.
stage director, and
right.
the stage director is a very strong personality, can be used the music really to negative effect, in the same way that if you have a strong conductor and a weak stage director, then he uses the music simply, the staging simply to choreograph.
But are you
the
conscious,
music.
For example, when you conduct, I mean, the standard charge brought against Wagner is, of course, Beckmesser, that Beckmesser is really an anti-Semitic caricature. Now, in the performances that you've conducted at Bayreuth, which I've seen with
Andreas Schmidt,
right, Beckmesser is not that kind of figure. First of all, he's not dressed in the traditional way. He isn't a hunchback. He isn't a repulsive-looking figure who probably smells, you know. Remember that book the guy wrote about all these sensuous associations with Jews. So, in other words, you feel that you can be conscious in making of Beckmesser through the music, and obviously with the cooperation or not of the stage director, into a kind of real figure and not a caricature of something.
Well, I think that the Beckmesser is a Stadtschreiber, what do you call it in English?
He's a town clerk.
Town clerk. He was also the head of the police in that time. In the military, he was head of the police.
Yeah, so not.
I mean, so how can you expect a Jew to be head of a police and all
right.
that? I don't think. Therefore, this is for me the proof, if you want,
right.
that it was not intended as an anti-Semitic character.
Well, then there's the argument that the things that he sings.
Having said that, I think that he uses certain aspects of the zeitgeist, of the time, that ridiculed Jews. But I don't think that the subject of the opera is that.
No, I agree with you.
I don't think Shylock is an anti-Semitic figure.
Yeah.
Beckmesser is not.
Right.
Beckmesser may have Jewish traits put onto him which are meant to make people laugh or to ridicule the personage.
Right.
In other words, I think that Wagner was very much aware of the fact that in his time, if you wanted to ridicule something, which is the case here, I mean, the whole point about Beckmesser in the third act is that he is being ridiculous and everybody laughs at him. Well, if you want to ridicule somebody at that time in the late 19th century, you made him, give him a little Jewish color to it, and you had it in it.
Yes.
And I think this is all it is about. If I really believed that the Meistersinger was about an anti-Semitic character, I wouldn't be able to conduct it.
But how is the claim made, which has actually been made in a book which I reviewed some years ago, that when you listen to the funeral march in the Eroica of Beethoven, you feel ennobled and dignified. It's like a great experience. When you listen to the funeral march in Götterdämmerung, you feel hatred and hostility towards Jews. This is actually a remark by a historian and a scholar. To me, it's complete nonsense.
It's total nonsense. I mean, if you want to feel disgust, you can feel disgust. Maybe this is because the person in question felt disgust for the person of Siegfried, and he feels that the whole thing was bombastic and ceremonial about somebody that he looked at negatively. I mean, you know, it's like the funeral of Stalin or the funeral, you know.
Yeah. I think obviously the context is what determines it in the end, don't you think?
Of course, I don't think there is anything either moral in the funeral march of the Eroica, nor anything immoral in the funeral march of, yeah. But there's a book about that called Beethoven in German Politics, and the use of Beethoven's music in Bismarck's time, during the Nazi time, in the East Germany, and, you know, it became everybody's...
Everybody's... You know,
but I think that this is also very, a very interesting question about the power of suggestion of the music and of the performer, if you want, of the performer. There are sometimes when you read wonderful poetry or you hear a piano recital and you think, it is so simple. It is, see, if I could play, I would play it exactly like this. If I could write poetry, I would write exactly this kind of poem. And in fact, I can do it, although I've never studied piano and I can't write poetry. And then you have the other kind, you read poetry, very impressive, very impressive. Gives you the feeling, totally beyond me. In the world will I be able to come close to that. I'm in awe of that. Or you hear some wizard playing piano octaves at 200 miles an hour and loud and everything. My God, to play the piano like this. You're in awe of that. Never ever. And I find the first actually not only more satisfying but much more productive and much more beneficial experience for the listener too.
Yes, yes.
I have been in situations, I know, where I have played the piano to, you know, to audiences, you know, who thought, my God, you know.
How does he do it?
In Birzeit, in drama. I'm sure there were many people there who were at the piano recital for the first time.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And they must have thought, how, you know,
how did he do it?
How does he do it? You know, and
well, then it becomes like a form of athletic or acrobatic performance.
Yes, you know, and it gives me great pleasure to be admired and all that. But the warmth of the reaction of and somebody who listens and says, it is so, when you play it, it is so simple, it is so self-evident.
Yes, yes.
But it's, for me, it's a much more beneficial reaction.
RAI, Argentina al mundo. RAI, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAI, Argentina vers le monde.
RAI, Argentina to the world.
RAI, 世界に向けて, Argentina.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
RAI, Argentinian in the world.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
A birthday that we want to mark today is that of Mauricio Viravent, who is known by his stage name of Moris. Moris is a member of the first generation of Argentine rock back in the mid-1960s. Rock emerged in cities like Buenos Aires, mainly in Rosario as well. And this is the country, and I always underline this, I always emphasize this, this is the country where rock began to be written in Spanish for the first time. Until then, there were rock bands, but they either played cover bands of English or American bands, or they wrote original songs in English, which was perceived as the language of rock. The Big Knicks, those are the Shakers in Uruguay. These are bands that emerged in those years. But they performed, they wrote their songs in English. And Moris is among the first, together with Lito Nevia of Los Gatos, Manal, Javier Martinez and Manal. These are the first that wrote lyrics in Spanish. And what lyrics? Well, very, very good lyrics, highbrow, poetic lyrics that became the seed of what we call rock nacional or Argentine rock. from Argentina, rock expanded, or Spanish language rock expanded to other countries of the Spanish-speaking world. But Argentina is the forerunner. And definitely Moris is one of the members of that first generation of rockers that wrote their songs in Spanish. He left a number of anthems, but there is a particular one that I include in the category of pop culture. Songs that are owned by the people, that become part of a country's legacy and cultural identity. Why? Because everybody knows these songs. Everybody loves this song. You play this song now, 50 years after, and it still works. More than 50 years after, 60 years. When you are playing guitar with some friends around a fire or in a gathering, and all of a sudden when alcohol starts going around, people start asking and making requests of songs that everybody can sing, that everybody know. Not strange, odd tunes that only the performer knows, and maybe two, three people in the audience. But everybody knows this song. We want to sing, all of us, Una Que Sepamos Todos, a song that everybody knows. Play that, please. Definitely, Moris wrote one of these songs, a song that you can include in this category, among many others. But this is a classic, a very beautiful song that tells the story of a bear that is captured and then is taken to a circus. He makes friends there, he makes children happy, but one day he's able to escape from the circus, go back home. He's old, but he's happy because he's home. It gives me the goosebumps, the same way this song has always given me. Well, this is the song, El Oso, the Bear, by Moris.
Yo vivía en el bosque muy contento, caminaba, caminaba sin cesar. Las mañanas y las tardes eran mías, a la noche me tiraba a descansar. Pero un día vino el hombre con sus jaulas, me encerró y me llevó a la ciudad. En el circo me enseñaron las piruetas y yo así perdí mi amada libertad. Conformate, me decía un tigre viejo, nunca el techo y la comida han de faltar. Solo exigen que hagamos las piruetas y a los hijos podamos alegrar. Han pasado 4 años de esta vida, con el circo recorrí el mundo así, pero nunca pude olvidarme del todo, de mis bosques, de mis tardes y de mí. En un pueblito alejado, alguien nos cerró el candado. Era una noche sin luna y yo dejé la ciudad. Ahora piso yo el suelo de mi bosque, otra vez el verde de la libertad. Estoy viejo, pero las tardes son mías. Vuelvo al bosque, estoy contento de ver.
Okay, this is the DX supplement produced by Arnaldo Slain, starting right away with hearings from Botswana. We recommend you to pick up The Voice of America, broadcasting from Botswana via a transmitter they have in Mopan Hill, Botswana. You can attempt picking up a transmission by VOA on the frequency of 4,930 kilohertz, on the frequency of, 4,930 kilohertz, 60 meter band at 5:30 p.m. UTC time. Remaining in Africa, we've got Radio and TV of Mali broadcasting on 5,995 kilohertz, 49 meter band at 6 a.m. UTC time. Another station that we can mention is Radio Dengue Gel, broadcasting to the Kurdistan via the transmitting site located in Yerevan, Gavar, Armenia. The station can be picked up on the frequency of 11,530 kilohertz around 6:55 UTC time. Let's recall that Kurds do not have a state of their own or a territory. Most of them live in the Middle East, northern Iraq, eastern Turkey, western Iran, and small areas of northern Syria and Armenia. In total, the Kurds are between 25 and 30 million people. They never reach the status of a nation state. That's why the Kurdistan is considered the non-governmental, the largest non-governmental state in the world. Moving on now to VORW Radio International, broadcasting every Monday, reaching Asia, targeting Asia, thanks to a transmitter of 250 kilowatts of power located in Issoudun, France. They broadcast to Europe, the Middle East, Central Asia, South Asia, the Southeast Asia, and Australia. This is the timetable for them. Monday, 15:30 UTC time, 17,810 kilohertz. On Mondays, they broadcast on 5,950 kilohertz to North America at 1 a.m. UTC time. They also use the frequency 4,840 kilohertz to North America. On Tuesdays, they target Eastern North America and Western Europe on the frequency of 15,770 kilohertz at 2000 hours UTC time. On Wednesdays, they target the East Coast of the US at 11 p.m. UTC time on the frequency of 7,570 kilohertz. On Thursdays, they broadcast on 9,395 kilohertz with a power of 100 kilowatts, targeting Western Europe and the East Coast of the US. On Thursdays at 4 p.m., they broadcast on 15,770 kilohertz on the frequency that I just mentioned, 15,770 kilohertz, with 100 kilowatts of power for the East Coast. On Thursdays, the frequency is 9,955 kilohertz, 100 kilowatts of power for a broadcast targeting South America that you can pick up, I repeat, on 9,955 kilohertz at 11 p.m. UTC time. If you happen to pick up this station and you want to send a reception report, write down this email address. VORWinfo@gmail.com. That's all for this week's DX supplement, Kind 73s.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
RAI, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAI, Argentina vers le monde.
RAI, Argentina to the world.
RAI, 世界に向けて, Argentina.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
RAI, Argentinian in the world.
RAI, Argentina al mundo.
And before signing off, let's go over the headlines again. Argentina signs the G20 declaration with dissent over the 2030 agenda. Uruguay, presidential candidates debate ahead of next Sunday's runoff. Ecuador declares a 60-day state of emergency over wildfires and power cuts. Argentina and Brazil sign Vaca Muerta gas export deal. Paraguayan president hospitalized at the G20 summit. And in sports, Argentina faces Peru this evening in World Cup qualifier. This way we come to the end of today's edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior, that was operated by sound technician Walter Danesi and hosted by yours truly, Fernando Farias. Thank you very much for listening. Hasta mañana.